getting too worried because there are repairs that can be made. How exact is this, and how do you feel as you actually make cuts into the wood?
Well, yeah, there's a certain nervousness. I'm just starting on a new part of the making. I've done my three bodies, and I'm starting to do the scrolls. And there's a new sense of exactness that, you know, kind of goes into this step that I need to get, you know, even more accurate than before. And so it's taken me a while to get things just right.
So you have to have a lot of patience to do this.
Mm-hmm, very much so. Mm-hmm.
And what happens if you are cutting something like the scroll or an F-hole or something that's supposed to be so exact and you make a mistake?
You learn how to do the repair on it, yeah, which is very helpful when you either get out of school and, you know, you have to do that kind of repair, or you're actually in your repair semester and you've already had some experience doing that.
So you have a pretty calm attitude about it as you go along.
The changes from day to day, you know, I mean, there's certain things that now I look back on and that used to, you know, really I was anxious about, but...
For instance?
Some of the first semester students are doing what's called flattening plates, and it's another form of flattening that I'm doing now, and it took me quite a while to do it. When I did my second and third instruments, it was much easier, and I knew better how to use the plane, how to use my straight edge and the square, and just, you know, rip into it and go for it.
Now you're a pro, at least in that area.
Yeah, I think so. Feel a lot better about it, and so I'm, you know, I'm going to do three of these, preparing these neck blocks for the scrolls, and just makes your accuracy keener and keener as you go through. Mm-hmm. I'd like to work probably for a few years in an established shop, gain some more experience doing repair, and it's like you work in one shop and you find out what they have to offer, what that shop has to offer you, and you learn all you can there, and then possibly you go on to another shop and learn what, it's a never-ending process of learning. Some people, you know, after they've done that, go and open their own shops. There's a lot of different possibilities.
Is it easy to get a job in this field?
This school is very respected. Mr. Lee has an excellent background, and since I've been here, the students that have graduated have done very well with jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's twofold. Our background with Mr. Lee and the kind of education that we're getting here. So,
you're not worried?
No.
I think we're going to have to put a little bit more in here, but now you can start test fitting. Let's see how it looks. Oh yeah, there's some flatness in here and a little bit over here, not so bad. So now you can go back to the strap, or you can go more free-handed if you want. And heat that up and start bending like so.
I found with the others I used freehand all the way through, and it worked a heck of a lot better than the strap did for me.
Yeah. Well, that gets down to, you know, personal taste, what you like.
You can also use blocks of wood.
There is what we call an inside form. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the base of the violin itself. Once this is completed and matches the outline of a template, which we have, I'll show you later, the blocks are made. There are four corner blocks and two end blocks on each instrument. And these are squared down to exact specifications, height, and width. They are then glued on for most of the construction process. They only come out right at the end. As you can see here, The beginnings of the curves are then drawn on, and then these are gouged to match the shape. Mm-hmm. Okay. These will be what the ribs are glued onto. These are the only points where the sides or ribs come in contact with the pieces of wood. See, otherwise they're freestanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very light skeleton.
What kind of wood is it?
The sides are made of maple, usually a flamed maple, which gives you that striping effect. Mm-hmm. A regular maple will not give you that. The corner blocks and end blocks are usually spruce, willow, or willow. Mm-hmm. Once these have been shaped, the ribs, which you saw before, are bent to match these curves and they're glued to the corner blocks.
Mm-hmm.
So the ribs are actually loose from the form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We go on then to do the plates. Most violins are made of two pieces, and these must be joined together in the center. That is a whole complex process in itself. Once joined, the outline is sawn, and the plates are then start to be shaped. As you can see, this one isn't hollow at all. It's the flat plate. You start with the outside shape, mm-hmm. which is gouged. The man making the cello now is doing that process. Mm-hmm. And the edges are then prepared for the purfling, which is that black striping mm-hmm. that you see in the violin. Once this area is ready, the inside is gouged out very roughly. Mm-hmm. This just lightens the plate and makes it ready to be what we call temporarily glued on. It doesn't matter if there's gaps, it's just on there so that when you go to do your purfling, mm-hmm. you have a basis.
That's P-E-R-F?
P-U-R-F-L-I-N-G.
Okay.
This is without purfling, but it's ready to get the purfling channel in, which is knifed in and picked out, and then the purfling is fitted in.
What's the purpose of that? Just distinctive look? Or?
Distinctive look is probably the second purpose. The first purpose is the purfling is into this height here and actually breaks the plate, giving it sort of a hinge. Without that, the plate would not vibrate as easily. So that's the mm-hmm. primary reason. As you can see, here's a violin with the purfling in, mm-hmm. and it has been finally shaped. And the ribs, the blocks, one step which I didn't tell you about was the linings.
Mm-hmm.
They're at the top and the bottom, and they provide stability.
Mm-hmm.
If not, the ribs would crack more easily and lose shape. And then the base bar is added before final gluing, and we'll discuss that later. And F-holes are put in. So it's a very, very, very rough.
What did
and brief.
You call this?
The F-hole,
uh-huh.
because it is shaped like an F. Mm. And this is a traditional style. I don't know how many makers, I think people who want to buy violins are not apt to buy something that's a little bit strangely shaped. I don't know how much, I don't believe that the shape of this has that much to do with the sound production.
Mm-hmm. As long as there is one there.
Yes, there must be this outlet.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, that's a real...
Okay.
So it was rough gouging.
Okay.
This is the initial step, as you can see. You know, this is the rough wood here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to get a basic shape and get his edges down so that he has less work to do when he knifes.
Mm-hmm.
And with the cello, as you can tell, there's a lot more wood to take off than on a small violin plate.
Uh-huh. What kind of tool is he using?
He's using a plate gouge.
He actually has
several. And they're in different sweeps. They're very, very narrow and very broad sweep. They're made to remove lots of wood quickly. Again, you're not going to do this to make a final smooth shape. This is just mm-hmm. to get the wood off.
Is there? There must be a trick to doing this. Can you take? You might take off too much and ruin the whole thing.
You can do. Yeah. What you try and do is get the I guess, horizontal arch from end to end, get the rough profile. And then you use the light here to create shadows, and that way you can see the general curvature for the other dimensions for going crossway across the upper boat and across the lower boat here.
Yeah, he's doing a tricky part here in that he's gouging against the grain, and it is easy, it's possible to lift off a piece of wood. So you have to watch what direction you gouge, especially in the center area.
So if you've taken too much, you have to start over.
No, we never start over again. There's always a repair you can do, or if you do, in a case like this, take too much wood off, you just have to live with it and change the arch. It just may not look as nice or sound as well. It's a mistake.
Mm-hmm. And your name, please?
Tom.
Your last name?
Wilder.
Okay. Have you made something before? Is this your first?
I've made 3 violins and a viola, 4 violins and a viola.
And this is a cello?
And this is a cello. And it's a lot bigger. And it's just more work. It takes twice as long, at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I...
This is a good one.
It makes lots of noise. Hang
on. A lot of effort, that energy.
Change, and how do you know it's changed that fast?
What you do is before you actually, don't worry, just keep going, run your wood on the planer. You take a straight edge and check it in all angles, lengthwise, widthwise, and crosswise. And if at that point you don't see light, we use a lot of light to check. You do not see light, it means you've got a flat surface and you're ready to do your planing.
And how often do you have to check to be sure it hasn't changed?
It depends on, like I said, the weather change. For instance, it's dry and fairly stable right now. Cold, but stable. He may not have to do much with it. If he leaves at noontime and lets it sit and there's a lot of store opening, he may want to every 2 hours give it a check. Or as he's running his boards and he's noticing he can't get a flat surface, that might mean it's the plane that's off.
What about in the summer, say, on a humid day, what happens to it?
It changes a lot more. It absorbs the atmospheric moisture. And joining in the summertime is a whole different ballgame. What he's doing is he does not want a perfectly flat surface. He wants a slight... closed at the ends and slightly gapped. Then, when it's pressed together, it forms a firmer, makes a firmer joint. If not, it has a tendency to open at the ends.
So it's very exact. That slight gap in the middle is still very exact.
It has
exact.
To be a certain, you have to, it has to not be too large, can't be too small, has to be a certain length, and has to be even. Mm-hmm. And I think that... from personal experience, it's one of the hardest things about making the instrument. Because if it comes apart on the instrument, it's very, very difficult to fix.
And that would happen much later in the process.
Yes.
You might have the violin almost finished and then suddenly it would come apart.
Right. So you want to, it also has to be square. So he's checking for the squareness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one, as you're pressing it over the board, it's very careful to keep over it and don't do any... tottering. You have to have a straight shot.
So it's a long board with the
blade
razor blade
in the
middle.
Right. The plane blade is actually fairly thick. This is a very, very hard blade and must be razor sharp or you're going to end up with even more problems. The glue is gone. I wish it was here. He's going to use hide glue. We use a hide glue, which is often rabbit hide, that's dried. We add water and make almost like a thin syrup consistency. glue. And one of the reasons we use it is it's a strong bond, but it's also one that can be pried apart for repair. If you used Elmer's glue, you'd have almost too strong. You can't get a top off to fix it. It's there forever.
Who makes hide glue? Where do you get it?
Where do we get our glue?
Oh. Just cute. Overall, that's the first thing you notice when you come in here, that it's very dark in here.
We use light a lot to check symmetry. The arching that Tom's doing is going to be done by eye only, as far as making sure that his right and left side match, that he has the shape lengthwise. It's done by eye, using the light to create shadows.
So everybody has these high-intensity reading lamps at their work table.
Right, and many students prefer a darker room because you get more contrast with the light.
So you're constantly holding your work to the light, looking across it for shadow.
And adjusting your lamps. Varnishing is another story. There you want natural light, and our varnish room has the open windows. So, there are certain steps you need more or less light than others. So this is very important.
Otherwise, you keep the shades drawn?
Most times, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sort of just cave kind of atmosphere.
Yeah.
And yet once, I had the same impression when I first came. It's so dark. But when you've got too much light in your room, you have a very hard time seeing your work. Mm-hmm. And it's almost annoying. Many times people will leave a very light area and go to a dark one. When you're scraping the top, all the smoothing is done not with sandpaper, but with metal scrapers, because they provide a cleaner surface. You must have light, a very dark room and a lot of light to see that, because you don't want any scratches. It's got to be a perfectly smooth surface. Again, by eye. There's some dimensions, of course, that you must follow, and we do have tools for checking symmetry. But as far as shaping of the scroll and the top and back of the violin, it is a lot of eye work.
But they all turn out really the same?
The more violins you make, the better your eye, quote, becomes. The first couple violins, you depend a lot on the teacher. You take your work before you go on to the next step, and many times, my first instrument, I thought I had it. It was fine. And, held under light, I was, it's a flat spot, or it's not symmetrical. And once it's pointed out, then you begin to see. So a lot of emphasis on using your eye is done here, so that you don't have to depend solely on instruments.
Are these students that otherwise have some kind of artistic background?
We've got people from all walks of life, so to speak. We have people who had been musicians and may have piddled in woodwork before. I would say most of the students either are artistically inclined. It's not the kind of work that if you don't have a little bit of patience or at least the ability to train your eye, you're not going to be successful, and you're going to be very frustrated. So many students had done some carpentry work or had built other folk instruments on the side before they came here. Some people came with no experience at all, just wanted to do it.
I'm curious about the National Public Radio. First of all, your name?
Dr. William Heller.
H-E-L-L-E-R.
Right.
Let's stand a little away from the coffee pot is all. Just stand back here a little bit so we don't hear it. And you were a retired dentist?
Yes.
Here. How did you get involved in the school here? Why are you here?
I've been interested in violins since I was about 9 years old, and I thought I'd like to make a violin and find out what it's all about, and I heard about it on a television program on I've forgotten what station, but it was in December, so I called up and applied.
Do you have any artistic background or something that you think might have prepared you for being able to work with wood in such an exact way?
Well, being a dentist, you work with very exacting standards, and this just follows along. So it's a little different medium, different material, but essentially it's the same.
And what will you do with your instruments when they're done?
I don't know. It depends on what they look like and what they feel, what they sound like.
I mean, did you plan to sell them or to keep them or go into another business for yourself? Or?
At my age, I don't think I'll be going into another business very much, but something to occupy my time and my mind, and it's very fascinating.
Do you play the violin yourself?
Yeah.
How old are you?
74.
Okay. Do you have maybe children or grandchildren who also play that you play?
I have a daughter that plays.
So any of these planned as gifts with her or anyone else in your family?
Could be.
You're not sure. Just see whether you like them or not when they're done.
That's essentially it right now. We go one step at a time.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
Just start.
The tools that are used for violin making, while there are some very specific tools, a lot of them are tools that are used for other woodworking purposes. We use a lot of block planes, which is a general woodworking tool. The saws, wood files, squares, as far as checking things.
But they're all hand tools, no power tools at all?
We do have power tools. We have a drill press and a band saw, which are not used here until you do just the rough marking out of the scroll. The first instrument a student makes uses no power tools at all. The only other time the bandsaw might be used would be to cut out the rough shape of the plates. Some people choose to saw them out by hand, but those are the only times we can use.
Is there an advantage to doing it all by hand? Increase the value?
Increases the value. And I think, this is my personal opinion, I think you get a better feel for the instrument and what you're doing. There's so much in just a piece of wood that if you're doing machine work, and some might disagree with me, you get to know that wood. You know, where, what direction it's going, the feel of it, and it's hard to describe. But I can see, I have not used the bandsaw yet on anything, any part of my instrument. But I prefer the handwork. And I think you're also closer, since we are building traditional instruments from traditional patterns, you feel like you're producing an instrument that's closer to the old masters, mm-hmm. which are the instruments that, at least to this date, they've never quite been able to duplicate in quality.
Is everyone here, do they all play the instruments as well? Or?
We, before coming here, there's a variety of skill levels. Some people have never touched an instrument. We are all required to take private lessons. Every other week we get a private lesson, and we all perform in a school ensemble, which is very interesting because we've got all the way from beginners to professionals. But it's the purpose is to build a student's ear for hearing what kind of sounds a violin makes. Because they can make a violin, if they can't make it sound, then they can't tell what kind of violin they've produced. Or they can't listen to another instrument and judge what kind of sound they're hearing. So the teacher concentrates not necessarily on making skilled musicians, but on teaching someone to get a sound out of the instrument and judge that sound.
Explain to me maybe what exactly you're practicing. What are the things that you're trying to improve? What are the hard parts about it?
Knifing skills in general. Just being able to control your knife and get it to do what you want it to do, what your eye sees.
What happens if you can't control your knife? What do you get by mistake?
A lopsided F-hole.
Do you have a pattern, like a paper pattern that you've traced, or?
Yeah, you've got a template. It's made out of plastic. You can see that, can't you? And you just trace it on there according to which way your grain's going, and you saw it out, and you can just start cutting then. It's your knife.
How many will you do to practice before you actually put one on your instrument?
As few as possible, hopefully. I don't know.
Yeah, it's up to the instructor.
Uh-huh. But yet, if you don't have it exactly right, certainly you're not. What happens if you put one on your instrument that isn't quite right? It's too late to go back, isn't it?
Then you get Mr. Lee to repair it for you.
Yeah. It's repairable?
Some of them.
Some of them, yeah.
They like fill it in somewhere or something?
Yeah, you can graft a bit of wood in there and recut it.
So as you go about doing things like this, do you, I guess at first I had this feeling of like every move you make is really very important, but you don't have that kind of fear about every cut that you put into the instrument?
Only when you get close to your finished product, then you really have to pay attention to what you're doing, pretty much.
Why is it different then than earlier?
Well, you've got quite a bit of wood and a lot of processes to waste away, and that's not the final product. And it's preferably probably to remove that as fast as possible, you know, so you can get down to the finer sort of cuts you're making.
So the more time you've invested in it, the more careful you are with the next step?
Yeah, you just try to be careful all the way around because some things, like, you know, just aren't repairable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and your name, please?
It's Mark.
Your last name?
Wirzman.
Can you spell it?
W-I-R-Z-M-A-N.
Where are you from?
Delaware.
Okay, all right.
You saw what Tom was doing. He has done that. He's made his edges very flat and very smooth, ready for purfling. And then he's taken it from that edge up, and he's doing his final shape. And he's doing this with a finger plane, which is specific to instrument building in general. It's a very small brass plane that is, these are a little bit rounded, so that he can get into the curved areas of the instrument. And what he's doing with this, he's got a toothed blade. And if you can see, it's got stuff stuck in it, which is producing this sort of combed effect. And the advantage of that is he's removing a lot of wood on the maple. You don't want to do this on spruce, which is the top.
Mm-hmm.
You'll chew it to bits, and it's a much softer wood. Because the maple's a little bit harder, it's going to remove wood faster. When he gets it to the point where the shape is satisfactory, he will then scrape it. Get a scraper handy. Yeah. As we said before, you don't use sandpaper. You use a metal scraper, which is cabinet scrapers are, you know, a tool used by most cabinet makers who use hand tools. These are maybe a little bit thinner and rounded, so that you can get in the rounded areas. Mm-hmm. And he's going to scrape. The edge has been sharpened and then curled under. So it's almost like,
there's a burr on the edge.
There's a little bit of a burr that's just sharp. Mm-hmm. And as he moves it over, it's going to actually cut the wood. Sandpaper just rubs it. It's not as much of a cutting action. So he's going to get a cleaner cut and a cleaner surface. Which is
Can you feel that difference when you're done, if you run your hands over it? How does it feel compared to a sandpaper surface?
Sandpaper tends to make a fuzzy surface. And
when you cut it, it'll be a little more glossy, I guess.
Yeah, you almost have, and you can use the light to see it, you can almost see just the smooth. If I can find
almost
someone.
Reflection.
Yeah.
This is actually sanded, I think, by now. You
but
can see a little bit of refluence. Yeah, there's a little bit of a gloss from it. It's fine 220 sandpaper.
And you can even feel the smoothness. Mm-hmm. It's very, very smooth.
Mm-hmm. So when you put varnish over it, that makes a different effect?
There are some makers who will scrape finished, use a very fine, thin scraper, and with that you can get a higher gloss finish, make it look thick.
Uh-huh. It's got to be absolutely smooth for that varnish. Before Mark varnishes this, he'll probably do another cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, he's got a ways to go.
Okay, and your name, please?
Oh, Mark Wentz.
Okay. You want it to change shape in some natural form, or doesn't it? I mean, after it's all done, isn't that part of what ages an instrument?
I think so. You're getting into areas that I'm not very familiar with.
Sign our guest book. Here I see, for example, Clifton Fadiman.
In the late 1600s. So.
David Teckler is a name known to those who work with violins.
Yeah, it's for cello. It's famous maker. So.
So who brought it to you? Does it belong to someone involved in the school, or?
No, it's a repair done for Mr. Lee.
So are you a little nervous about repairing on something so valuable?
Sure. Yeah.
How valuable is it?
I can't give you appraisal on it, you know.
No guess, a rough estimate of it. I can't. Just give people an idea. You don't know? Do you know? No idea. But certainly the most valuable thing you've ever worked on.
Sure, yeah, it is.
Give it back to you. So what do you have to be careful of when you're working on something like this? Do you have you follow?
The idea is to keep everything as original as possible. And when you do repair something or restore something, you want to make sure you don't depreciate the value of it, as you know. So.
And this was repaired improperly, you said before, or restored improperly?
Improperly, and also at the same time, it's hard to say.
What was wrong with it? Is it something you can explain?
Is this the original here?
Yeah, this is the original here. And what happened is Mr. Lee and I had decided to redo the graph on this because the wood did not match, first of all, and that there was depreciating the value of the instrument because it wasn't matching. And so we have found a piece of wood that could match with it, and then as we worked on it, we noticed the reason why this was done, the repair before, is because the original wood was really had wormholes and all that. So
by matching, you mean the actual grain?
Yeah, the grain, and also the joint for strength and so forth. And
this is, does it restore it to its full value?
No, you can never restore it back to the full value, but.
It's all right. Okay, and how long have you been a student? What semester are you?
This is my last semester, so.
Okay, and your name, please?
Peter Yang.
Can you spell it?
Peter Yang, Yang.
Thank you.
Peter's working on the bass bar, which I really didn't talk to you a whole lot.